From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I like to talk about your type of comedy that you do. It's sort of observational with, like, a twist on it.
Yeah.
That's director, writer, and producer Judd Apatow when he was 15, interviewing Jerry Seinfeld for Apatow's high school radio show.
It's funny to hear your voice before it changes, you know. So sometimes you say something and then it's weird and you make it funny.
Apatow has collected his old and recent interviews with comics in his new book, Sick in the Head. Today, Apatow talks about his teenage years when he was obsessed with comedy, but also did things that could have gotten him into serious trouble. Apatow went on to write and direct The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. He's an executive producer of Girls and directed Amy Schumer's new film. And David Bianculli previews the new season of HBO's True Detective and two new HBO shows that begin Sunday. That's on Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. You'll hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order. Alt Latino is from NPR Music. You can find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi, this is Jerry Seinfeld. I'm a well-known comedian. If you listen to club comedy on WKWZ in Syosset, which is where you are, you might as well, because it's with Judd Apatow. I don't know if you know this guy. If you've ever seen him, he is an incredible, incredible guy. I mean, just to look at him is an unbelievable experience.
That was Jerry Seinfeld in 1983 doing a promo for Judd Apatow's high school radio show after Apatow interviewed him. Apatow was obsessed with comedy in high school and succeeded in getting some impressive comics to let him ask them questions. Those interviews, as well as Apatow's recent interviews with comics, are collected in his new book, Sick in the Head. Apatow started his career in the footsteps of his idols, doing stand-up comedy, but he became famous as a movie and TV writer, director, and producer. He was a writer and director of the TV series Freaks and Geeks, wrote and directed the films The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, and This is 40, produced Superbad and Anchorman, is an executive producer of Girls, and directed Amy Schumer's new movie Trainwreck. Judd Apatow, welcome back to Fresh Air. You really had chutzpah to interview professional comics for your high school radio station, a show that probably, like, nobody listened to.
Nobody heard it.
So you managed to, like, snooker agents or publicists into thinking that you were an actual professional working on a professional radio station. So you get your foot in the door. The comics see you, see that you're, like, this 15-year-old kid. I mean, how did you then have the confidence to fake the rest of it and act as if, yes, you really belong there interviewing people like Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld, Steve Allen?
I just wanted to be in the comedy world so bad that there was nothing I wouldn't do to get access to comedians. And I had a friend, Josh Rosenthal, who worked for our high school radio station, and he would go interview REM or Susie and the Banshees. And I thought, wait a second, we can get interviews with professional people, even though our signal doesn't even get out of the school parking lot. And I started calling up the publicists of comedians. And I think, you know, back then, no one wanted to talk to comedians. There was no internet. There was no podcasting. So getting any call about an interview probably made a publicist think, hey, I look like I'm doing a good job. I got Seinfeld an interview on WKWZ radio because the offers probably weren't coming in back then.
Yeah, but still, like, once you get your foot in the door, you have to look confident. You have to make it seem like you know what you're doing. And you probably weren't confident, and you probably didn't know what you were doing. The only thing you were probably super confident of is that you wanted to be there and you wanted to talk to this comic.
That's true. But also, the only thing I knew in the world as a little kid was comedy. And no other kids in my school cared about it at all. There was no one to talk about it with. You know, we're in a geek culture now where comedy is so giant. I'm one of the people that works on Funny or Die, and there's just a giant culture of comedy nerds. But back then, I was alone, and I had a little confidence about it because I felt like, this is my thing. This is the only thing that only I know about.
So I want to play a clip of your 1983 interview with Jerry Seinfeld. So set the scene for us.
Well, he had been on The Tonight Show and The Merv Griffin Show a bunch of times, but this is many, many years before Seinfeld. And to me, he was just, the guy who's the greatest observational comedian alive. I had seen him perform a bunch of times. And even back in 1983, he was the greatest. So I got a time to interview him in California. I visited my grandma on vacation and set up an interview with Seinfeld. I show up at his apartment. He's got zero furnishings. Literally, every wall has nothing on it. He is just all comedy. There's like a couch, chair, and that's it. And he opens the door. Me and my brother are there. He gives me a look like, oh, okay, children are here. And then he's incredibly nice. And I ask him, how do you write a joke? How do you become a comedian? And he was nice enough to explain all of it to me.
This is, I think, a really interesting, insightful part of the interview that I want to play. So here's Judd Apatow, my guest, interviewing Jerry Seinfeld in 1983. And this is the lead interview in his new book of interviews with comics, Sick in the Head. And remember, Judd Apatow is 15 when he is recording this interview with Seinfeld.
I'd like to talk about your type of comedy that you do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe it? It's sort of...
It's funny.
Observational with like a twist on it. It's not, some people just tell a joke, like an observation, and that's it. But you add a whole new dimension on it.
Yeah. I'm eating it, though. I'm going to sound like I'm chewing. Because I am. Well, it's one thing to see something, you know, and I think the next step is to do something with it, you know. Like I'm doing this routine now about this guy that was on That's Incredible last year that caught a bullet between his teeth. And it's like you see a thing like that and you go, what the hell is that? You know, I mean, a guy catches a bullet between his teeth. And now I don't know what's funny about that. But I think to myself, there is something funny about that. And that's what I like to do. Other comedians do different kinds of things, you know, but... That's what I want to do. And I explore that, and I think, you know, what job did he have before he got into doing that? What made him go, you know, I'd rather be catching bullets between my teeth? You know, and I don't know, just I have a whole routine about it, but to me that's funny. You know, I don't know, that's the way my mind works, I guess.
So how do you develop that?
Trial and error. You know, just try out one joke. I had this other thing about how I don't remember his name. You know, I saw this guy do it, right? Caught the bullet. I don't even know his name. Now, if he knew that I didn't know his name after seeing that, wouldn't he feel like, what the hell do I have to do? You know what I mean? Isn't that impressive enough for people to remember me? I mean, what, do I got to catch a cannonball in the eye? Or what is like... So it's like, I guess keep thinking on it until I, you know, hit something.
So that's an excerpt of Judd Apatow at the age of 15 interviewing Jerry Seinfeld. The whole interview is in his new book of interviews with comics called Sick in the Head. So that's a pretty interesting insight about how he takes an observation and has to like work through. So what's funny about that and all the trial and error stuff? Did you love hearing that when you were 15?
It transformed me. It was the first time someone explained what stand-up comedy was and how you develop it. That was probably the most important moment of the 45 interviews I did as a kid. It was just simple. And also, Jerry Seinfeld grew up two towns over from me. And when I met him, I thought, I'm kind of like him. I'm just a Long Island guy. And it made me feel like a life in comedy was possible because this guy who felt similar to me was this amazing comedian. And then I asked him to do it again. We did another interview about 6 months later, and he said, why would I do it again? I already did one with you. And I said, well, you did The Tonight Show more than once. And then he did another interview with me. We did like another hour 6 months later. That's the nicest guy in the world.
So once he told you that he tries to figure out what's funny about this, and he sits down and he works through it, did you start doing that yourself?
I did, but I was so unfunny. I look at how funny young comedy people are today at 17, 18, 19. I can't believe it. I may have gotten funny like 2 years ago. It took me a long time to really figure all of this out.
So what's it like for you to listen back to your 15-year-old voice?
Well, it's fascinating because I've lost most of the Long Island accent. I got a little Long Island in me. It's funny to hear your voice before it changes, you know. So it's funny that there's still a little like, how do you do it? How do you write a joke? So sometimes you like you'd say something and then it's weird and you make it funny. So it is painful to hear how dumb you are. But I, you know, my grandfather was a jazz producer. His name was Bobby Shad, and he recorded Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington. But in the late 40s, in the early 50s, you know, he went down south with a tape recorder and he recorded all these blues artists on their front stoop. He was one of the first people to bring the recording equipment to those people. And I always remembered that he was a hustler and that if you want to make something of yourself, you just have to do crazy things, and that's what this felt like.
That's great. So let's hear another interview excerpt, and this is with Jay Leno in, was it 1984?
That's correct. At Rascals Comedy Club in New Jersey.
So you're interviewing him, and the way you start is so endearing because you're obviously kind of uncomfortable, and I can't tell at the beginning of the interview whether you're trying to put him at ease or trying to put yourself at ease. So let's listen, and then you can tell me.
Okay, right now, I know it's hard to get going. Once you get going, we'll be okay. Okay, where are you right now in your career, if you had to describe it, you know, with popularity?
About, 25 miles outside of New York, I guess. I'm in Jersey right now. Where am I? I have no idea. I don't really know. I mean, last 2 years or so, I've been doing the Letterman Show a lot, and that seems to have helped an awful lot. So, you know, the clubs are kind of full on Wednesdays now instead of just the weekends. So that's nice. But I don't know. I'm too close to it. I can't tell.
What would be people that you've opened up for?
Oh, everybody. Everybody from Stan Getz, Mose Allison, Rahsaan, Roland Kirk, Chick Corea, all the way to like John Denver, Tom Jones, Perry Como, Chris Christopherson. I mean, all kinds of people.
I remember I saw you once on Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah!
I know, I hate to bring that up. What is the point of doing that show at your stage, that stage in your career?
Well, the point of doing that show is the same point of doing this show. Somebody asks you to do it, you go, why not? You know, I mean, yeah, you do everything. I mean, I make fun. I mean, I like Penny and Cindy and all those people. They're good friends. And people ask you to do the show, and it's nice. I mean, okay, the show is not exactly King Lear, but that's all right. I mean, they're fun people to work with, and you do the shows.
Because that's the kind of thing you make fun of in your act.
Oh, sure it is. Sure it is. But I'm not above doing something I make fun of in my act. I also eat at McDonald's and all those other things I make fun of. But, I mean, that's all part of the business, you know. I mean, you can. I do Hollywood Squares. I do whatever people ask me to do, unless it's something which is just totally, I don't know. I mean, sexist or racist or something of that nature. But when you do those kind of shows, it just helps, you know. When I'm on TV, I'm either on The Tonight Show or The Letterman Show, which is on after 11:30 at night in most parts of the country. So consequently, there's a whole generation of people that never see you or know who you are. So when you do a show like Laverne and Shirley, it gives my relatives a chance to see me on television.
Okay, that's Jay Leno in 1984 being interviewed by Judd Apatow when, how old were you then, 16 maybe?
16. And have you ever heard anyone happier to talk to somebody? I mean, I'm literally jumping out of my shoes that I'm in the room with Jay Leno.
So when you say at the beginning, you know, like what do you say to him at the beginning? It's hard getting started and then it gets easier.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you reassuring yourself or reassuring him?
I think I'm just trying to see if I pooped my own pants. I'm just so scared and excited. There's way too many emotions happening right there. I mean, Leno, you know, was one of the main people that made me want to be a comedian. I listened to him on the Merv Griffin Show, and he was on the Tonight Show and the Mike Douglas Show, and he was a real hero of mine. And then was always incredibly nice to me when he was at the Tonight Show. He would have me on all the time when I was just some goofy director, and there was no reason to have me on. He always treated me as a friend.
I also love in this part when you ask him, so why are you doing like a stupid show like Laverne and Shirley? And he tosses it back to you and says, why am I doing this show?
And
I bet he was,
Laverne and Shirley.
Was really thinking that too. Why am I doing
exactly.
Why am I doing
again,
this
another
show?
Person that doesn't know a child is coming to talk to them.
But he's
but you
so
know what?
Generous.
I did him twice as well. Uh-huh. I did him twice as well. I cornered him 6 months later, and I did another one with him. I don't know where I got the cojones to do that. But really, my secret dream was that Jay Leno would turn to me and go, will you be my best friend? That was my 16-year-old dream.
Didn't happen, right?
It did not happen. Right now, we are distant close friends.
But what did happen, you asked him to do a promo for your radio show, and he obliged.
Oh, jeez. Do you have that?
We have that. So we're going to hear Jay Leno's promo. It's very funny, actually. So let's hear that.
Say whatever you want, really. Open. I should say, the name of the show is...
Club Comedy.
No, the interview, the name of the show is... Hello, this is Jay Leno. And you know, when I'm not working with the poor, I like to take some time out and listen to Club Comedy on WKWZ 88.5 FM.
Talk about chutzpah. You're a 16-year-old.
I'm making him promote the show.
Interviewing Jay Leno, and you're asking him to promote it. He doesn't even know the name. He's never heard of the station. He doesn't know you, and it's like, hey, do a promo for my show.
See, I think everyone's doing so much more press now that you wouldn't do all of those things. But then I just don't think there was much for them to do. I think comedians were way more bored, and I took advantage of that.
So it must have been odd for you, like in the period when he kind of, reclaimed The Tonight Show and Conan had moved to another network and everybody was saying like how selfish he was being. And you knew him as like the most generous person in the world from this early interview.
Well, I am a believer that it is a dogfight to get those talk shows, to keep those talk shows. Everyone is pushing somebody else out and jockeying for position. So I was never the person who thought that any of the players did anything wrong, because you're implicitly trying to get a show, or you're trying to not get pushed out of your own show. When I was at the Larry Sanders Show, the entire final season was about Jon Stewart pushing out Larry Sanders and taking over the Larry Sanders Show. I mean, that's just how it works.
Years before you even did these interviews, you wanted to be in showbiz. When you were in seventh grade, you got a series of headshots because you wanted to do TV commercials. Why TV commercials? Like, why weren't you aiming for maybe playing a kid in a Broadway show or being an extra in a movie? Why was like TV commercials the dream of the moment for you?
That just shows how confused I was. I thought the way to become an actor was to be on a Burger King commercial. There was no part of me that's like, I could be the kid in Les Mis. I didn't really understand anything about the process and show business. All I knew was some people did commercials. And I could be like Rodney Allen Rippey. I could be
who
one of those.
That?
You know, remember that kid who was like, it's a virtual Borgeschmorg. I could be, Mason Reese or something. And so I got my headshots. And then immediately, this terrible thing happened. I was trying to make my friends laugh. So I shoved poison ivy up my nose. That's how badly I was trying to get laughs. I get poison ivy all over my face. I start putting poison ivy medication on it. Then I get the chicken pox. But I don't know I have the chicken pox because I think I have poison ivy. And the medicine, it inflames the chicken pox. So now I have these like Godzilla-sized chicken pox. And I have scars all over my face. I look like Noriega. And that was the end of my chance of being on a Burger King commercial.
But you'd already had your headshots taken.
They were worthless because I was now a freakish-looking man.
So how long did it take for the scars to go away?
Well, next time we're face-to-face, you'll go, ah, up close. They're still there. I have one scar right in between my eyes that everyone used to make fun of me and say I had a third eye.
Wow, that must have hurt.
It did hurt. It was right when puberty hit. I was scarred.
So how did that affect the direction you wanted to take with comedy? you know, you had to give up on your dream of being a kid in a TV commercial. Was comedy already on the agenda?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. I definitely gave up for a few years because I was scarred. Because who knows? Maybe I would have wanted to take an acting class or something like that. So when my parents got divorced, this great guy, Rick Messina, he was a bartender at a restaurant that my parents owned. And then he later went on to open up the East Side Comedy Club in Huntington. And he had another club in Southampton. So one summer, my mom became the hostess at this comedy club. And at the time, I didn't realize it. But later, I thought, oh, I think she just did that because I liked comedy. Because how much money can she make seating people at a comedy club? It doesn't sound like that was going to make her break her financially. You know, she was going through a divorce and struggling financially. So it was a real gift to me because that summer I got to see every comedian in the world at this comedy club. And that's what inspired me to pursue it. And then I thought, oh, maybe I can interview these people. And I became a dishwasher at their comedy club so I could watch the shows.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, director, and producer Judd Apatow. His new book, Sick in the Head, collects his interviews with comics dating back to when he was 15 and working at his high school radio station. After we take a short break, we'll talk more about his teenage years and about the time 2 years ago when he was supposed to go on stage at a televised tribute to Mel Brooks and he panicked. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air and this message are from TastingRoom.com, the only wine club that fits your personal tastes. Here's how it works. Tasting Room sends you a kit with sample size bottles of wine. You sip each one, log on to their site, and tell them which wines you liked. Tasting Room then picks wines for you based on your tastes. You get your first full case right after you tell them what you like, and you get new cases of wine every 3 months from when you started. Visit TastingRoom.com/NPR to get your tasting kit.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judd Apatow. He was a writer and director of the TV series Freaks and Geeks, wrote and directed the films The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, and This Is 40, produced Superbad and Anchorman, is an executive producer of HBO's Girls, and directed Amy Schumer's new movie Trainwreck. When he was 15 and obsessed with comedy, he started interviewing comics for his high school radio station. Those interviews, as well as his recent interviews with comics, are collected in his new book, Sick in the Head. Your parents divorced when you were in, 10th grade or something?
Well, it started in junior high, and then I think they finally got divorced like 10 years later. It was a long back and forth of court dates.
Right. But they weren't living together during most of that time, right?
They were not.
Right. So when they separated, and it sounds like it was pretty acrimonious, for example, your mother called you, asked for your father's credit card number, and proceeded to charge about $30,000 worth of stuff, and your father didn't have that kind of money. So did you feel like you were starting to matter less in their lives, that they were looking out for you less?
Well, it was the era before conscious uncoupling. You know, now people, they go to the therapist to try to get along for their kids. But, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, people just went to war. And it happened with all of my friends. One by one, all their parents got divorced. And the parents would really vilify each other. And they would tell the kids everything that was happening. My mom did that much more than my dad. And so I was just classically in the middle in a situation that I didn't know how to handle. And, you know, they're both great people and we're both incredibly supportive of everything I wanted to do in comedy. My dad was the one who introduced me to comedy and he would drive me to all the clubs late at night. And my mom worked at the comedy club and they so believed I could pull it off that it gave me the confidence to do it. But they really could not find a way to get along. And that troubles you when you're a kid because you're looking to them for answers and you're looking to them for a way to navigate the world. And when they're, you know, fully you know, at war, you're not sure who to listen to and whose advice to take. And it makes you feel like you have to be responsible for yourself. And that's what drove me and made me think, oh, I got to get a job. I got to figure out what I'm going to do. I mean, I don't think my kids have that situation. I don't think that they're sitting around going, I gotta get the hell out of Malibu. You know, they've got a much easier situation.
You're right. Everything about how my family worked was based on guilt. Why should you have felt guilty, though? Because they were the ones who were arguing. They were the ones who are undermining each other.
Well, I don't know if that's my family or any Jewish family, but I feel like a Jewish family can make you feel bad about anything, even if they just go, hey, how you doing? I'm doing good. Oh, yeah. Well, it's good you're doing good. Then you just feel terrible all day long. Well, it's nice that someone feels good. It's nice that nice you feel good. Yeah, not everyone gets a chance to feel good because it's a hard time. But you get to feel good? Okay. Well, that's nice for you. That's nice for you. How are you doing? I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to bother you with it. Jewish people could just get you in any corner. I remember like going to the mall with my grandma and her just, I'd just go, come on, grandma, let's go in the mall. I'll just wait in the car. I'm going to be like 3 hours. I'll be fine. I'll occupy myself.
So you say in your book that you started shoplifting with the secret hope that you'd get caught so you could have an excuse to yell at your parents, this never would have happened if it wasn't for this divorce. What did you shoplift?
Oh, we used to switch all the price tags at the sporting goods store. So I would buy a tennis ball racket. I mean, a racquetball racket that cost $200. I would switch the price tag and make it cost $10. And then I would return it for $200 in credit.
No.
And then I would
have
$200 in credit. And then I would buy brand new skis. And because my parents weren't paying any attention, they didn't go, why does my 13-year-old have brand new skis? We did that for years. I mean, when I look back now, I think I was really doing some bad things. I remember we would take a BB gun and shoot out people's windows in their cars and steal their radar detectors and sell their radar detectors. I mean, we would like follow people home and blow out their window and steal their radar detectors in Southampton. And we'd be like, well, they're fine. They can replace that window. And I never thought how insane it was as a kid. I just was in some bizarre headspace that, I don't know, everything's so crazy, who cares? And I wanted $100 for the radar detector.
Wow, you are really, really lucky that you didn't get caught or beaten up or like end up just heading in that direction forever.
It's not that we did it that much, but, you know, I think we were all like hustlers a little bit. You know, most of our families, you know, were upper middle class, and then they would get divorced. And then, everyone would move from like the big house to like the tiny apartment. And we were just trying to figure out, how are we going to make money? What are we going to do? I remember cheating a lot, both in school and at poker with friends. And it just seemed like whatever we wanted to do was okay. And I never thought that much about the ethics of it. It wasn't like that dark. It was just like stupid stuff. And then later I thought, oh, it's kind of terrible to follow someone home, wait for them to go to sleep and steal their car radar detector. But at the time, it just seemed like a weird, crazy adventure, and no one was really paying attention to what we were doing.
So among the things that you had to deal with when you were growing up is that you were just about the shortest kid in your class, and you were the youngest kid in your class. You weren't athletic. Put those three things together. What impact did it have on you?
Well, it's a pretty humiliating thing when you get picked last every day in gym class, and then at lunchtime all the kids play sports and you get picked last. And at the time, I just thought, this is awful, because it defines you as a weak person. It defines you with girls. And if you're bad at sports, what you get this funny cycle where the ball never gets to you because now you're in the worst position. You're in like deep right field. So you can never prove that you got better. And so the cycle lasts forever. And it made me angry at attractive people. It made me angry at healthy people and physical people. Even now, if I see someone working out, you know, in great shape, like a 40-year-old guy with his shirt off, jogging, I always think, look at that idiot. Like that's why everyone in my movie is kind of goofy, because I'm a champion of the goofball. And but what sucks is I have to work out now, you know, not to die. I was always happy not working out, because I never wanted to be someone who worked out to look good. But now I have to try to not die, which is such a drag.
No, it's funny. I am very short. And in school, I was always like the shortest or the second shortest person in my class. But that did not diminish my status as a girl, because it's okay for a girl to be short in a way that it wasn't supposed to be okay for a boy to be short.
Well, I didn't realize it until years later, but my parents pushed for me to be ahead in the grade because I was the youngest person in the class, and I was supposed to be a year behind what I was. And, you know, when you're little, that year is impactful. You are smaller. You're behind in every possible way. You're not as smart. I mean, I'm not as smart for all sorts of reasons. I realized recently that one of the reasons why I'm not smart is because my mother didn't breastfeed me when we had our kids. My mom was like, why are you breastfeeding them? You didn't get it. You're fine. And she would be mad at us for breastfeeding. And then I read this study that said, you know, people who are breastfed are smarter and have better jobs. And I'm like, that's why everyone in my movie is high or in high school, because I can't even pretend to write for a smart person. I can't even fake it of like how witty people talk. So, and I don't know where any of the states are. I realized the other day, if you gave me an empty map of America, I could probably hit about 8 states.
When you first got on stage to do stand-up, what was your earliest material like?
My earliest material was all about how terrible I was. I used to do my act. I wouldn't get laughs. And at the end, I would say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the great Jerry Lewis said, you only learn by being not funny. You learn nothing by being funny. So thank you for giving me a college education tonight. And that was my closer. And that would get a big laugh because I bombed for the last 5 minutes.
How did your self-esteem deal with bombing?
Well, here's the funny thing. When I did the interviews, everybody said it would take 7 years to get good and to find yourself. So I had it built in my head that I was supposed to bomb for a couple of years. And so even though I didn't enjoy it, I thought that I was right on schedule.
Were you honest about any of your real insecurities on stage, or was your material just kind of jokes about stuff?
I really admired Bill Maher when I first started, but I was not angry about anything. It's hard to be a comedian when you don't have strong opinions, no stories, and no rage. And that's one of the reasons why I stopped doing it for 22 years. I had to build up opinions, stories, and rage.
You were asked to be one of the speakers at the AFI, the American Film Institute, tribute to Mel Brooks, which was only like a year or two ago. And
that's right.
So you were supposed to go on, I guess, in the middle of the show or something. And from the way you've told the story, it's like right before you're about to go on, you tell, I don't know, the stage manager or somebody that you can't do it, that you're not going to do it. And in fact, you didn't go on. Like, what was going through your mind then?
Well, I was asked to do a toast. And I'm not good on cue cards. I hadn't been doing stand-up comedy. I wasn't comfortable in front of people. So I thought, you know, I'll write some bullet points and I'll speak from my heart because I do love Mel Brooks. My wife can't go that night, and she's the one who always supports me and gives me the strength to do things which are scary. Because if I get scared, she'll say, you're great. Don't worry about it. You're gonna kill. It'll be fun. But she wasn't available, but my daughter Maude was, and she was 15 years old. Now, if I try a joke out on Maude, she's always like, I don't think that'll work. I've never tried a joke on her where she said, that's funny. She's always like, you think that'll work? Oh, God, don't say that. Please don't say that. I think that won't work, Dad. Because she's so worried that it'll go badly. So we're in the car, and her dress suddenly just tears like in half. And I'm all frustrated because I need to work on my speech in the car on the way there. And now I have to figure out a way to sew her dress back together. So we go and we sew her dress back together backstage at the show with all the people working on the show. I've had no time to prepare my speech. The show starts. I'm scared to death. Every show business person on earth is there. Martin Short opens the show, does a medley of every song from every Mel Brooks movie. It is like he worked on this medley for 2.5 years. It is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. Then Billy Crystal comes out, kills. Then Sarah Silverman comes out and says everything that I was planning to say more eloquently and funnier than I was about to say it. I turn to Maude for support. I say, Maude, I'm getting scared. I'm kind of freaking out. What do you think? And she turns to me and goes, Dad, don't do it. Don't do it. You're white as a ghost. Are you having a heart attack? You look like you're going to die. Don't do it. And I just had a raging panic attack. I walked up to the first assistant director and I said, I can't do it. I'm too nervous. Seems like the show's long. Why don't you skip over me? And they looked at me like, are you serious? And I didn't do it. And that show won the Emmy. So maybe I would have hurt that show and they would have lost the Emmy if I did it.
Have you ever done anything like that another time?
Is it
the only time?
One of the main reasons I stopped doing stand-up, I realized later, was I auditioned for something for Jim Henson. And Jim Henson didn't want to hire me. And I hear from the casting director, he'd like to buy your ideas, but he doesn't want you to appear in the show. He thinks you lack warmth. And I was like, Jim Henson thinks I lack warmth? That's like Mr. Rogers telling you you don't deserve love. He taught me to read. Years later, I thought, I can't imagine he actually told somebody to call me and tell me I lacked warmth. So probably it's just a mean casting director. But at the time, it really took the wind out of my sails. It made me think, oh, yes, this instinct you have to not perform has now been confirmed by Kermit the Frog.
You're right. My mind is a noisy place. I tend to look for problems so I can solve them before they blow up in my face. I am like a lookout for disaster. Do you think you were trained to be that way as a child?
Well, I think when you grow up in a volatile or sensitive situation, you don't feel that calm. And you're just looking for trouble and you're looking for ways to avoid trouble. And I think it's helped me as a producer because a lot of producing is anticipating a problem. Are we going to run out of money? Do we hire the right actor? Is the script ready? And you're planning for things, a year in advance. And I think that my general panic and catastrophic thinking makes me a better producer. It's terrible in life.
Mm-hmm.
It's the worst thing for your brain, but it helps you get the movie in on budget.
So one last question for you, and this is a very, very, very important question. Why are the interviews in your book in alphabetical order as opposed to chronological order? And why are they alphabetical order according to first name and not last name?
This is the best question
America awaits.
Okay. So, first of all, I don't remember the order, so I can do it chronologically. But I tried to do it like by section, like interviews with friends, interviews with mentors, things like that. And then I just didn't like how they bunched up. So finally I said, okay, let's alphabetize it by last name and then first name. And then I just liked the order of alphabetized by the first name. And then I started with the Jerry Seinfeld interview because I feel like that really kind of sets the table for what's in the book. But I think, it's meant for the toilet, Terry. It's meant for an airplane or bed. I mean, there's like 30-something interviews in the book. So you could open it up and go, oh, I'd love to hear Mike Nichols or James Brooks or Chris Rock. It's really more to jump in wherever you feel like it. You shouldn't read this like it's Infinite Jest or something. It's meant to be dipped into when you feel like it.
Well, who needs good reviews or a blurb when you could just say for yourself, it's meant for the toilet.
Sometimes you have to admit that.
Judd Apatow, it has been so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything that you have in the works.
All right. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you again.
Judd Apatow's new book, Collecting His Interviews with Comedians, is called Sick in the Head. He directed Amy Schumer's new film, Trainwreck, which opens next month. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of HBO's True Detective and two new HBO shows that premiere this Sunday. This is Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. You'll hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order. Alt Latino is from NPR Music. You can find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Last weekend, HBO presented the season finales of its three Sunday night primetime spring series, Game of Thrones, Silicon Valley, and Veep. This weekend, HBO unveils its new Sunday night lineup, the all-new second season of True Detective, and two new comedies, Ballers, starring Dwayne Johnson, the former wrestler who was known as The Rock, and The Brink, starring Tim Robbins and Jack Black. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is surprised and impressed by all three shows.
Let's start with Ballers. HBO has tried building a sitcom around pro football before. Way back in 1984, with one of its earliest series efforts, First and Ten. That show not only was flat-out bad, but one of its stars was O.J. Simpson, just a few years before he became infamous as well as famous. Ballers, though much of it deals with the Miami Dolphins, is more like another vintage HBO sports comedy, Arliss. Dwayne Johnson plays Spencer, an ex-Dolphin who is trying to make the transition from pro football player to financial planner for wealthy athletes. His boss is played by Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, who throws indignities at Spencer that The Rock, in a wrestling ring, would never have sat there and taken. But Spencer does, with a slow burn that Johnson delivers very, very nicely, as his boss complains about not locking up the estate planning for a football player who's just died.
Look, there's going to come a time, because you've been here a year now, where you're going to have to
monetize my friendships, right?
Yeah, but the way you say it, you know,
monetizing friendships,
it makes me sound like an all right? And I'm not. You know me. I hired you for access. For your friends, for players, even the ones you hate. I don't care. I don't care who it is. I don't care who they played for. What about Rodney, huh? He probably could have used your help. Can we manage his estate at least?
There is no estate. Tina was left with nothing.
Wow, you're kidding me, right?
No.
Throw in the sexy women, the lavish spending, the outrageous misbehavior, and the greedy entourages, and Ballers feels like the football equivalent of the hip-hop music world of Empire, just as entertaining and even less predictable. HBO's other new comedy, The Brink, is even more recognizable as a variation on a theme. It's got an indecisive U.S. president, advisors who range from sensible to bloodthirsty, and an out-of-control pilot on a bombing mission overseas. Yes, it sounds almost exactly like Stanley Kubrick's brilliant apocalyptic anti-war comedy, Dr. Strangelove. But The Brink has its own modern take on the nonsense of war. This series really takes chances with its casting, and those chances really pay off. Pablo Schreiber plays the loose cannon pilot sent to target Pakistan after a military coup there results in fears of World War III. Two comics who work superbly together here, Jack Black and Asif Manvi, play a low-level State Department envoy and his driver on the ground in Pakistan. And back in the White House Situation Room, Tim Robbins, who's hilarious, plays Secretary of State Walter Larson. And when he picks a fight with the military advisor pushing for an immediate attack, even the president can't stop the bickering.
Walter, talk to me.
Mr. President, I'm in the process of tracking down moderate elements in the Pakistani government. Give me 24 hours to find a different way.
We don't have 24 hours, Mr. President. We need to remove those weapons now.
Spoken like a true chicken hawk.
You're out of line, Walter.
Am I? I was on the damn roof defending the last chopper out of Saigon before my 19th birthday. When you were 19, you were date-raping Radcliffe girls, you. Or was it Harvard boys?
Finally, there's True Detective. Like American Horror Story and Fargo, it's designed so that each season of episodes stands alone, telling a new story with new characters and mostly new actors. Last season, True Detective, with its grim flashbacks, was a combination murder mystery and character study, starring Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. This season, once again created by Nick Pizzolatto, is about a different murder and involves new investigators from three different jurisdictions. Those investigators, all with troubled pasts and abrasive personalities, are played by Colin Farrell, Rachel McAdams, and, from Friday Night Lights, Taylor Kitsch. And in scenes set in both the past and present, the lawman played by Colin Farrell has an uneasy relationship with a local white-collar criminal played by Vince Vaughn. In a flashback, we see their first meeting, when Vaughn's character summons Farrell's street cop to give him some information regarding the cop's wife, who has just been brutally attacked. He slides the cop a photograph, along with a note with the name and description of the man he has heard bragging about the crime.
Fits the description, right? My people know him. He's not with us. Amphetamine freak. Bragged about it, said, matched your wife's account.
How do you know my wife's account?
This is only information, man. I'm sharing with you. I wanted to do this. And now it's done. That's it.
What do you want from me?
Me?
Yeah.
Not a thing. Maybe we'll talk sometime. Maybe not.
It takes the entire first episode for the main characters to be thrown together. But as soon as they are, you realize there's no predicting what they'll do, which ones to trust, or even which ones will survive. It's the beauty of the miniseries form, and True Detective uses it expertly. As with HBO's other new Sunday offerings, I didn't know what to expect until I previewed them. But in all three cases, I've ended up pleasantly surprised.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air.
Remember, it's the higher octave on the upbeats in the bridge.
Hey, Brian.
That's Paul Dano as Brian Wilson in the new film Love and Mercy. I'll talk with the film's screenwriter, Oren Moverman, and we'll hear excerpts of two interviews I recorded with Brian Wilson, the musical genius who created the sound of the Beach Boys. I hope you can join us tomorrow.
Wouldn't it be nice if we
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Grouse.